You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Scopes Monkey Choir. Is that the name? Yeah, that's the podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism.
Well, I really need to learn that subtitle. This is episode 50.
50.
The big 50.
And it's our Halloween show.
Ooh.
Which doesn't really mean anything, but
yes, it does.
Well,
it means we're going to talk about something spooky.
Spooky.
We are going to talk about something spooky.
Werewolf bar mitzvah?
I don't know if that counts as spooky.
But first, news. But first, we must
some
play the news.
Spooky news.
Oh wait, let's play the sound first.
That is spooky.
Ooh.
That's way better than
All right. This is the sound. People who have heard any of our talking about space sounds and the sonification of radio signals and stuff, you may recognize that sound. Because it's the same kind of thing. We're talking about atmospheric radio signals.
This now, is the radio signal from the aliens?
This is it. We have exclusive...
oh, no, wait. The ghosts. This is the ghost sending us radio signals.
You're going to do this the whole episode, aren't you?
It's the Halloween storm.
God help us all. It is the Halloween storm. Well, you just said it. The Halloween storm.
They're calling it that. They're just calling it that because it's around Halloween, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. And lest you think that we're just saying Halloween storm because it's Halloween, there is actually new news on this.
We didn't name it that.
Yeah, the Halloween storm was a major solar storm between 19th of October and November 5th in 2003. It's one of the biggest solar storms on record. We had huge coronal mass ejections, are big blasts from the sun, and they throw billions of tons of electrically charged hot gas out. And
yikes.
It can, disrupt satellites. It can cause blackouts. It can do all sorts of exciting things. So this, one of the biggest ones, was called the Halloween storm. Now, the reason this plays into that sound is that one of the things that's been figured out recently is that there's this thing called chorus waves. Now, and this is a type of aurora. Now, am I getting... This is getting complicated.
It is, because aurora is visual, right?
Right. Aurora is visual. And as you probably know, the intensity of the auroras is affected by the sun and by coronal mass ejections, can make bigger auroras.
Isn't aurora the interaction of the ejecta from the sun and the Earth's magnetic field?
Yes, indeed. So, but this is slightly different, this sound that we're talking about. But just interesting factoid, though. The aurora during the Halloween storm in 2003, they were so intense that they were seen from Florida.
What?
At times.
And they were orange, too, right, for Halloween?
They were kind of. I've seen some of the pictures, yeah, but I don't know if they picked... I don't think they were orange the whole time. I think people picked the pictures. It's the Halloween storm, So there's this thing called the chorus waves, and this is another kind of aurora. It's called the diffuse aurora, as opposed to discrete aurora, is the kind that we know that you can really see. The diffuse aurora is generally not visible, but it's actually more extensive, and it can pulsate. And what it is a type of very low-frequency radio wave. And what has been figured out actually very recently is that what is happening is that these radio waves that are in the atmosphere are actually knocking these low energy electrons down from space down through the atmosphere.
Oh, wow.
That the sound that we heard is the sound actually of this other kind of aurora. Now, what I like about this sound, this sonification, is unlike, say, the radio signals from, say, the atmosphere of Saturn that we listened to a couple episodes back. Unlike those, that sound, here's a little bit again. So that sound is actually not adjusted. that is actually, if you turn your radio on at the right frequencies, if you know where to put your radio on, that is actually what you will hear coming from it. So it's not adjusted. The these signals in our atmosphere are actually happening in frequencies that human beings can hear.
What?
So they don't have to slow them down the way they usually do. Because, can you hear radio waves normally?
Well, I'm a little confused about that, actually.
No.
The radio waves are electromagnetic, and when we translate them through a membrane, we hear them out of...
Right, but as opposed to having to slow it down and say, okay, if we could hear in the...
Waves aren't actually perturbing air particles, but when you translate them through an electromagnet onto the speaker, to the speaker, they make a vibration that we hear.
Right, right.
Wow, I just understood something. It's amazing.
It's a beautiful thing. So the reason the vague reason why this is news is that there was actually a new model.
What frequency can we tune our radio to hear that?
Oh, I can't tell you that. I don't know. I don't think it's quite. We're in New York City. Anywhere you turn your radio, you're going to hear.
It's between stations. I'm a ghost station. I interrupted an actual piece of information.
So there's this new model of this. Chorus wave. They call it chorus wave by because of the sound. Because they think it sounds like a chorus of
aliens.
Of insects. So there's a new model of it that actually is predicting that if there was another superstorm, even just a little bit bigger than the Halloween storm of 2003, that it could actually cause atmospheric disruption of satellites for several years. They're thinking that it actually could be really, really bad. So it's like another thing to try to figure out, because it will eventually happen.
Because we have so many more satellites use now than we did in 2003.
Yeah, I don't know how many more. 2003 wasn't that long ago.
Oh, so much has happened in satellite technology since then.
I am sure that is true, but I know nothing about
Everyone in New York City would be lost now if they couldn't use their GPS while walking around.
I guess that's true.
Oh, that's terrible to say.
So one other new news item before we get on to our...
So the Dance Your PhD winner has been announced.
Yay! Dance Your PhD is a contest that has become annual, I think, where scientists are invited to make a video where they use dance to explain their PhD thesis.
And it's required that the scientists themselves be in the dance video.
Very important. So the winner this year is Joel Miller, a biomedical engineer at the University of Western Australia in Perth. And he won, along with his friends, for his video called Microstructure Property Relationships in Ti-2448 Components Produced by Selective Laser Melting, a love story.
Aww.
So we'll link to that. It's a really nicely done video.
It is.
Very nice.
He won $1,000 and a trip to Belgium to receive his prize.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Joel.
Now then,
we have for you a news story from beyond the grave.
News of the world, January 1941.
Bats use super shrill cries to pilot themselves in dark. Flying the beam of inaudible sound waves, bats avoid mishap, guided by echoes from obstacles.
Stickles.
So basically, we found the article that was published when they discovered that bats use sonar, and that's how they described it.
It was so cool. So we didn't know that bats use sonar until 1940. This article is January 1941, and...
I like this sentence. One of the most puzzling mysteries of biology has been solved. If airplane pilots could utilize the skill and flying mechanisms of bats, flying would be safer in peace and war.
War.
It's so strange. It's so fun to read this old.
It's so different. Science. And you are hereby ordered to go look at the show page to see the picture they have.
Oh, everyone
of
is
a
ordered.
1940s yes. scientist holding a bat up to a microphone. It's the best picture ever.
Except well, it's a little sad if you love bats.
It's a little sad if you love bats, which we do. And this is all about bats and echolocation.
Yes, for Halloween, for our for our Spooks Monkey Choir episode.
Oh, God.
We are talking about bats.
So, Haiting, would you do us the favor of giving a little overview of what the hell echolocation is?
Sure.
You don't sound like you want to.
Well, let me say, first of all, that how many species of bats are we up to now? Like over 1,000 species of bats
I couldn't tell you.
The world, something like that.
I thought it was 700.
There were over 900 already known in 1998.
Oh.
That was the last time I checked the number of bat species, but there's an enormous number of bat species.
Yeah, it's estimated that it's 25% of mammals, right?
25% of the number of species of mammals. Not that they make up 25% of mammals.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Of mammal species. So, and about half of them use some form of echolocation, as that 1941 article said, super shrill cries.
Sonar!
They didn't actually say sonar at that point in the science history. So, half of these species of bats use echolocation to find their way around. And basically, they produce sounds in the same way we do, most of them, that is, using their vocal cords, their larynx. They bring little folds of flesh together and pulse air through them. And they produce sounds that are in the range of 20 kilohertz to 200 kilohertz. And that's 20,000 hertz.
Right, 20,000 hertz is generally considered the upper limit of human hearing.
Right.
And 20,000 hertz, only probably the youngsters could hear such a high sound.
Right, so
by the time
when
you're
they
a
say,
teenager, you can't hear that shit anymore.
When they say super shrill, they mean super shrill, supersonic, so yeah. We can't really hear them. Although there are some bats that produce sounds that we can hear in their echolocation. There's another way that some bats produce sound to echolocate, and that is, yes, by clicking their tongues. And they are a different family of bats, generally, that do that. And then they listen for the echoes. I mean, pretty much everybody knows
they
this.
All
they
know that.
They all know this. They all know this. Okay, so they have some bats have most bats produce the sounds through their mouths. That is, they fly with their mouths open while they're producing the sound. But some of them, the sound comes out of their nostrils. For instance, the leaf-nosed bat.
Mm.
Which is an old world species, I believe, that a European species. And they have these big sort of leaf-shaped flaps around their nostrils to help amplify the sound that's coming out of their nostrils.
Uh-huh, okay.
Here's another cool thing, because the bats that produce sound with their vocal cords, of course, have to use air to produce the sound. Most of them, when they're just flying around, kind of generally looking for prey, not searching down a particular one, when they're flying around, not bumping into walls and things, they coordinate the production of sound with their wing flaps so that the muscular energy of the wing flap also contracts their lungs and pushes out that little bit of air
to create
the squeak. So need no extra energy to produce that sound. Mm-hmm. And that is until they're honing in on something. And as they're honing in on something, hopefully to eat, they produce their sounds faster and faster, often with a sort of like crescendo of echolocation tweets, beeps, clicks,
chirps,
thank you, to get better and better location.
Right.
What else?
I have some more details about that kind of thing a little later on.
Okay.
But
let me say also that they produce different kinds of sounds. They produce something called constant frequency, which is one frequency, a steady tone. And then they produce some, which bat biologists call CF, constant frequency. And the other kind of sound is frequency modulated, which is rising or falling.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently low frequencies travel farther. So they use that as general sort of like don't bump into walls sound.
Mm-hmm.
And higher frequency gives greater specificity of information. So they use that to find smaller things.
Makes sense.
I will also say that the loudness, the decibels of these sounds, they're extremely loud.
I was gonna hit that later on, but yeah, it's crazy.
I saw one article that the loudness is from 50 to 120 decibels, and they get even
more than that.
Really?
The Leisler's bat in Europe, I believe, has been measured at 127 decibels. Now, so, and 127 decibels is like, if you're near that, you get hearing damage. Like,
but of course we can't hear it, so it doesn't.
No, I know, but I couldn't believe when I was reading that stuff, because basically, if you're in a forest with bats, you should be so glad that you cannot hear above 20,000 hertz, because if you could, you would never sleep. Like, we're 120 decibels. We're talking like standing relatively near a jet engine. This is loud, loud sounds.
Yeah.
And it sort of makes sense. Like, you know, just humans evolving, like, why wouldn't we be able to hear higher? Well, maybe that's one of the reasons. Like, if you're trying to fucking sleep at night and you have to sleep and it's important for whatever reason, we still don't know why. But you have to sleep. If they're all this, like, if jet engines are going by, like, all the
time.
Well,
they're extremely high pitched. I saw one article that compared 120 decibels to holding a smoke detector up to your ear.
Yeah. Oh God. I'm so glad we can't hear
now.
It.
But I want to also say that bats have really cool mechanisms to cope with their own sounds, because if they, their own sensitive ears, were to constantly be hearing things at that decibel level, first of all, they might go deaf. Don't know if their ears work that way. But second, they would probably not be able to hear the echoes. So they have this very cool mechanism by which, just before they produce a chirp at this high decibel level, they contract a special muscle in their middle ear that separates the three bones in their ear.
Wow.
So that the sound they produce is not heard by them. And then the muscle relaxes just in time for them to hear the echo.
Wow, that is crazy.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But it also makes you wonder about bats flying around together. You know, they often are near each other. Like, yeah, no, are they just deafening understand. Each other all the time?
I didn't see anything in that.
Anyway, I wanted to mention about the hot debate. Hot debate time. Which is the evolution of echolocation is being fiercely argued. There's back and forth, biologists
ripping
out each other's hair. Because they have,
like, one single bat fossil from 54 million years ago.
Well, yeah, and they need to find more fossils. Because basically what happened is that there's this bat ancestor, agreed on bat ancestor, called Anecanicterus fennei.
In the range of 50 to 54 million years ago.
And in 2008, there was a paper, I think it was in Nature, sort of a big deal paper that basically said, you know what? We figured out that this ancestor could not echolocate based on the inner ear, the bones of the inner ear. But then 2 years later, just last year in 2010, another paper came out and said, not so fast.
Basically by showing that there were some bats alive today that had that same structure of the inner ear, right, yet did use echolocation.
And then also pointed out that the fossil that the first paper was basing it on, the actual location of the inner ear bones in the fossil, isn't necessarily where they actually were. Because
it's all flattened.
Yeah, it's all flattened and everything. So still, like I say, people's hair being ripped out, eyes gouging out, screaming, echolocating scientists at each other. Sonar being, I'm...
Yeah. Wait, I've completely lost you. It sounds like a Halloween massacre over there.
I'm saying nothing anymore. I am finished.
Okay. So let's have a little more about how about the physiology and neurology of how bats
Yeah, I wanted to mention this because when you get, you gave a good general outline, but then when you get into, you know, as you mentioned, you have all these different species of bats, and they all have sort of slightly different variations on echolocation, and so we can't sort of generalize beyond a certain point. You can't generalize. You actually have to look at the individual species. And so there are some interesting things, like a lot of work has been done on the Egyptian fruit bat. And the reason why is that the Egyptian fruit bat is one of the tongue click bats.
Uh-huh.
And it's generally been felt that the tongue click is not as precise as the vocal apparatus bats because it's not as precise a sound. It's like, you know, as opposed to, you know, a whoop, whoop,
this is one of those that you can actually hear, right? We can hear a lot of the tongue click bats.
I can't answer that question.
I'm pretty sure that we'll find some audio.
So they've done some detailed analysis of the Egyptian fruit bat, and they've figured out some interesting stuff. Like, for instance, they make their tongue clicks. They can alter the width of their sonar beam.
What?
First of all,
how do they do that?
They can focus it. They can focus it. So yeah, I mean, sound will always go out 360 in some sense, but they can actually focus in and make their beam more precise. And so what they actually do is that when they're out just looking around and trying to, you know, check out what's going on, they actually echolocate to the right and to the left and to the right and to the left. They sort of go back and forth in this sort of wide arc. But then as soon as they figure out something that they want to concentrate on, they actually bring in the beam and then concentrate on that thing. And then the other thing they do is they as you mentioned before, they use volume to their advantage. And if there's an obstacle that they need to get around, they actually increase their volume because they think the reason is that if there's an obstacle that you want to, you know, make sure that you don't hit, that you increase your volume a bit, and it sort of makes it more likely that you're going to get a detailed image back, so to make sure that you really avoid the
thing.
That's
very interesting, because chirping bats, actually, when they're around a large obstacle, will usually decrease the volume, and they think that so they don't deafen themselves with all the
which
echoes
makes sense.
Coming
yeah,
back.
Which makes sense.
There's actually a really interesting thing that I read about bat neurology and volume of sounds. Apparently, in most mammalian hearing, this is just a fascinating fact on its own. In most mammalian hearing, the less the intensity of a sound, the slower the sound is transmitted within the neural pathway, not within the inner ear and the actual physical workings, but once it gets into the brain.
Yeah, and when the intensity, are you talking about volume?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So the softer the sound is, the slower a certain set of neurons reacts to pass the sound, pass the impulse on to the next set.
Which is weird.
Which is a little
but
weird.
But interesting.
And here's the interesting bit about bats. Those particular type of neurons in bats do not slow down when the volume is turned down, because they have to so precisely tell the timing of returning echoes.
Right.
No matter what the volume of them. So they manage to not have that slowdown in softer volumes.
Very interesting.
There are actually a bunch of things about bat neurology. Of course, they have many specialized functions in their brains for detecting all these ridiculously fine sonic differences. Like, for instance, they can tell, horseshoe bats in particular, but I think they're fairly representative of chirping bats. They can tell the difference in, 0.0001 kilohertz difference in pitch.
Wow. That's amazing.
Which is like,
that's so much more precise than humans, right? I mean,
of course, like a half step around the area of middle C is about 15 hertz difference.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah,
I believe that the human ear can distinguish maybe 10 or 12 gradations in there. So like 1 or 2 hertz in that range. Of course, the number of hertz between half steps changes depending on what pitch level you're at.
But yeah,
we can't, we're distinguishing differences in pitch somewhere on the level of a hertz.
Right.
And they're distinguishing 0.0001
Yeah, so
well,
they're
that's
like
kilohertz, so they're, like 0.01 hertz or something.
Right. So still, they're they're.
Oh gosh, we just tangled ourselves up horribly. But they're so much better at distinguishing pitch.
I think what we're trying to say is that bats are cool.
Yes. Here's another cool thing about their hearing and neurology mechanisms. You know, in the inner ear, how we have the basilar membrane, which vibrates as sound waves come in our ear. And by us, I mean mammals.
Mm.
And it's the thing that curls up in a little snail Oink. Shape in the cochlea. So, right in the particular pitch area that bats really need to distinguish finely, they have a thickening and lengthening of that basilar membrane.
Oh,
so
wow.
They have like a huge enlarged area for just exactly the pitch range that they need. Mm-hmm. And across different species of bats, depending on what pitch they use, because they all use different pitches.
Uh-huh.
In fact, different species of bats can live in the same area in peace because they use slightly different pitch ranges to echolocate, so they don't drive other species crazy.
That's crazy. Evolution.
But that was a little parentheses.
Is there anything that doesn't mutate at some point? I mean, everything can change. It's amazing.
Wait, basilar membrane, cochlea.
Right.
So they have an extended area right at the pitch range that they need. And of course, a corresponding enlarged area in their brain that receives all those extra signals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, and then along the same lines of, we know this about big brown bats, but it's probably true of a lot of other bats too, is that distance and location is also aided not just by where the bouncing signals back, but even by the harmonics of the signals that come back. So the harmonics being the sort of higher notes that are within any sound.
Go back and listen to our episode on the harmonic series.
So big brown bats have been found that they know that higher frequencies are weaker if they're coming back from the sides or from objects that are further away, right? So they actually did these tests where they took recorded sounds of bats echolocating, and then they messed with the recordings and like dampened some of the high frequencies and such and played them back to the bats, and the bats got totally fucking confused, and they were like, I don't know if they literally were going into walls or something, but they get even just the tiny details of like the how loud certain high frequencies are can tell them details about where things are, and it's just amazing.
Right, and they're using Doppler shifts to tell whether things are moving towards them or away from them. Apparently they emphasize the Doppler shifts in those upper harmonics because they're more pronounced in order to tell specifically whether things are moving towards them or away from them.
Right.
And in a much simpler way, which this people already, our listeners probably already know, they use stereo hearing. Each of their two big ears, like our 3D sight, they use their stereo hearing to tell whether something is to the left or the right, whether it reaches the right ear or the left ear first. But they also can tell whether things are above them or below them, what elevation things are at, because they have a special flaps in their ears, and they can tell which flap the sound hits first.
Oh, that is insane.
It's all insane.
Bats are so cool. So we should also talk a little bit about the Great Battle, which is
The Great Battle.
Nice.
What great battle?
The great battle between bats and moths.
Oh, right.
Mothra and Batra.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so bats
this really
like moths.
This really is a Halloween
moths.
Episode.
This is a really silly episode is what it is, but it's about bats, so everything is okay. Bats really like moths because moths are really yummy, as we all know. And so there's this continuing evolutionary battle going on between them. And moths have all these defenses. Like,
first of all, moths can detect echolocation sounds.
Sonar. So sometimes they'll just, if they detect sonar, they just drop. They just stop flapping and they just drop. But also the bats have a counteract thing too. At least some bats, they call them whispering bats, but they're really just, they're Western Barbastel bats in Europe. And they've been found to, their echolocation has gotten really quiet. Now, as we mentioned before, the echolocation is really loud already. So when they say quiet, they're talking about around 94 decibels or something like that.
Actually, I saw some literature that suggested that pretty much all bats that feed primarily on moths make quieter echolocation sounds relatively than bats that feed primarily on other things, because moths can detect the sounds.
Well, I guess I'll just put it this way. This is comparing this Barbastel bat to the Leisler bat, which is in the same, I mentioned earlier, in the same, they have the same, similar habitats and everything. And they actually wanted to find out whether that quieter decibel thing really does work. Actually, this is an excuse we can listen to some bat sounds, which is nice. So here is the sound of a Leisler's bat. Now, this, unlike our initial sound from space, this is slowed down. It's like a tenth of the speed. This is much, much slower. So this is a Leisler bat.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. So once again, that's slowed down quite a bit. And
that would be a frequency modulated chirp.
Exactly. So that's at like 127 decibels, which, as we mentioned before, is like, you know,
which
jet
we
engine.
Cannot do loud enough for right. on your earbuds.
And here is the Barbastel bat, which is slowed down just as much. Yeah, so two bats.
That, too, is a frequency-modulated chirp. It's much shorter.
Yeah, it is.
And what is the decibel level on that one?
That one, the decibel level on that one was 94, which is like 94 decibels is still pretty low. It's compared to like the sound of a busy highway from 10 meters away or something like that. So still pretty
still
loud.
Really
but
loud.
The difference is huge. What they discovered in studying these bats is that Leisler's bat, the first one, which is a lot louder, that the moths detected them from 30 meters away.
Ah.
The moths realized that
yeah,
bat
got
was
no
there
chance,
from 30
bats.
Meters away. And then the second one, the quieter one, the moth didn't realize the bat was there until it was 3.5 meters away, which is basically so close that there's nothing the moth can do. So, and then they went and actually examined good old bat feces out in the wild. And they concluded that there is significantly more moth in the Barbastel bat, the quieter bat.
Mm.
So it seems to work.
Guano yeah. in the Barbastel
oh, yes.
bat, guano.
Guano, yes. Thank you for the precision. And then what other, is there, there's probably some other, oh, the tiger moths.
Tiger moths.
Okay, now here, this is one of those great nature things where you're just like, all right, first of all, we have these crazy mammals that can use sonar and used it millions of years before human beings even thought of it. And there they are using it. And then we also have the only known, there's only, in nature, there's only one animal that is known to jam sonar. And that is the tiger moth. And bats like to eat tiger moths, and the tiger moths do not like to be eaten by bats. Well, we don't know for sure that they don't like it, but we suspect that they don't. So tiger moths can jam bat sonar. They click. Tiger moths make their own clicks. Now, what is there is not consensus yet as to why the moth is able to do it, exactly what the mechanism is.
Right, how it's making that sound.
No, not that. It's that it's how their clicks are throwing the bats off course.
Oh.
There are various hypotheses, but there is a front runner right now based on some very recent research. The front runner is known as the ranging interference hypothesis.
What?
And the idea with that is that the moth clicks degrade the precision of the bat's sonar. So they did all these tests where they basically checked the details of the clicks that both the bats and the moths were making, and they discovered that when the moths are making their clicks, the bats get slightly confused about where the moth is, and they miss it more often.
Oh, wow.
And so that's the tiger moth jamming the bat sonar.
When they've seen and proven that the moths are somehow confusing the bats, they just don't know exactly how.
Right, yeah. Though, I don't know. They're pretty convincing there.
Right.
That testing they were doing. So, and then other, you know, other, what do we call them? Beings, plants, animals. What are those all called? Living things. That's what they're called. Other living things, too. As you probably know, bats can pollinate, too. And
bats can bats produce pollen?
The bats can pollinate flowers, just like birds and bees and such.
Yes,
do, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the question has been, like, it's clearly flowers have evolved to try to visually attract birds and bees and such. Like, hey, come pollinate me. The question has been, have any flowers evolved to attract bat pollinators? And I have to say that it's actually not consensus yet, but there's this one flower, which is this vine called Macgravia evinia.
Tell me it produces echolocation chirps.
No, it does not. It does not.
Darn.
But it does have a leaf which is dish-shaped. And it's right over the part.
It has a little sonar dish.
Yes. It has a little sonar dish that grows, that is right above the part that it wants to have, where the pollen is. Now, scientists being all cautious, they're not declaring that. They're not yet declaring that this has evolved.
How would that attract the bat? Why does the bat like a little dish shape?
It's just easier for the bat to find. And they did these experiments where they had
just to land on.
It's just easier to find. They did these experiments where they had the same vines, and some had that leaf where it normally is, and some they actually got rid of that leaf where it normally is, and when the leaf is. That dish-shaped leaf is in the place that it normally grows, it halved the foraging time of the bats. The bats were just like, voink, there we are.
Oh, so it like amplifies the...
Yeah, I mean,
The bats are eating a bit of... They're
of
eating
pollen
the pollen
or something like that, yeah.
This is a perfect homing, perfect little helipad for the... It's
exactly.
Big X,
yeah.
For the bat.
If you're looking around by sonar, then it's really easy to find.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's very cool. And then the one... I have one last thing, if I may, because I know we're running out of time.
I got something. One last thing.
Oh, you go.
No,
please.
No.
Well, it was just there's this myth... that bats hunt less during the full moon.
Oh, that is Halloween-y.
Yeah, and it's true.
The myth is true?
It's actually been known.
What, do they turn into werebats?
They turn into werebats
they
and they're too busy
they
eating children, so they hunt less. No, it's actually true. It's been known to biologists for decades now that the bats are they hunt less during the full moon. They hunt more during the new moon. And but the thing that's changed is that for a long time it was felt it was a predation thing, that bats were more worried about getting eaten by other things.
Oh, could just
in the
because
light.
Other things could see them.
Yeah, but now it's starting to look like it's actually just a food thing, is that there are fewer insects out in the in the light of the full moon.
Huh.
And the bats are just like, you know, it's not really worth my time. So they go out a little bit, but I'm not gonna, you know.
That factoid is not really about echolocation, so that makes me feel better about giving this factoid that I just had to tell everybody because I think it's so cool, even though it has nothing to do with echolocation, which is this. You know how bats hang upside down to go to sleep?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so most mammals in their, you know, their little graspy hands or claws or feet or whatever they have, they have tendons and muscles, and they use their muscles to... You contract their muscles to curve their fingers.
Right. Uh-huh.
Now, bats, their tendons do not connect to muscles.
Ooh.
In their hands, in their feet, rather.
Their claws.
Because
yeah.
Their
yeah,
wings
the,
are
yeah.
their hands, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, instead, the tendons run all the way into their bodies, such that when they put their little talons around a piece of rock or a tree limb or whatever it is, then the weight of their body curves their talons.
Oh,
so
cool.
They just hang there, and with their body weight, their fingers are automatically curved. And then they just contract other muscles or flap their wings to release those tendons. So they expend energy holding on. So
that's
you can stop worrying about those little guys having to hold on all night while they sleep.
That's so brilliant. So efficient.
Like freight trains? What are you talking about?
No, it's true. Freight trains, or at least I was told it's true. I don't know if it actually is. But I've always heard that freight trains, really big trains, that the locomotives... the default position, it needs power to open the brakes.
Oh.
So if there's any failure, if the train loses power, the default is the brakes close.
Oh.
So you have to expend energy to open the brakes, and that's safer, right?
Wow, we have strayed so far
vaguely
from our
similar.
Topics.
Yeah, we should just
say. It's spooky.
It's
how
Halloween.
Far
it's I'm the cat's freaking out, and I'm scared and hungry, and the wolves are after me. And we should probably go.
Ooh.
Oh, we have to play the round.
Oh.
Okay, listen.
Here's the final word on bats.
I am a bat. I use my sonar eating bugs. I am a bat. I use my sonar eating bugs. I am a bat. I use my sonar eating bugs. I am a bat. I use my sonar eating bugs. I am a bat. I use my sonar eating bugs. I am a bat. I use my sonar eating bugs.
And that is a round by your very own Matt Shickley.
Host, co-host of Scopes Monkey Choir.
From ScopesMonkeyChoir.com.
We are professional musicians, not scientists.
If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself. We welcome your feedback, positive or negative.
Write to ScopesMonkeyChoir@gmail.com.
Or leave a message on the monkey phone at 347-788-0330.
I tweet at Squidocto.
And I tweet at ScopesMonkeys.
Bye.
Bye.